subscribe to our free podcasts. Details at the RN homepage.
Enjoying summer listening. RN.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online. I'm Paul Barclay. In this Big Ideas, we continue Didier Fasson's contemplation of punishment. He's the James Wolfenson Professor of Social Science at the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, and he gave this year's Tanner Lectures on human values. In the first of his lectures, Didier Fasson questioned the common sense as well as normative theory understanding of punishment, ending his presentation with what has become the core constituent of punishment, the infliction of pain. This has not always, nor everywhere, been the way of correcting an offence. As Didier Fasson describes, in our understanding of punishment, there's been a shift from a moral economy of debt to a moral economy of suffering. If you missed the first lecture, you can listen back to it on the Big Ideas website, abc.net.au/rn. Here, Didier Fasson analyses the thinking about punishment by social scientists, philosophers, and critical thinkers, and he draws on his own extensive fieldwork on French police work, court procedures, and prisons. After asking what is punishment, he now turns to the questions why punish and who is punished.
So why punish? If the cornerstone of the contemporary thinking on punishment is the principle of the separation between definition and justification, the former being supposedly value neutral, while the latter involves moral choices, the impassable centrality of pain, which of course does not have to be physical but can be psychological or better said moral, in the definition calls for a justification. How can the infliction of pain be justified as the repayment of a wrongdoing? The seriousness of the punishment, because of the suffering it generates, the responsibility of the punisher for imposing such suffering, and the distance between the sanction and the act punished, a suffering in reparation for a theft, a drug possession, or a traffic violation, for instance, definitely render indispensable to provide an answer to the question, why punish? This interrogation is, however, more ambiguous than it seems. It can be heard in a prescriptive sense, why should we punish? And in a descriptive way, why do people actually punish? The word why implies pure justification in the former case, and both justification and explanation in the latter one. Logically, most legal and philosophical writings adopt the first, ideal, meaning, while most social science research explores the second, actual one, although the line is not always so clearly drawn between the ideal and the actual, the normative and the analytical. Within the first paradigm, the classic justification for punishment rely on two main positions, utilitarianism and retributivism, with some variations and combination. The argument on both sides are well known. The utilitarian thesis, as a subset of the consequentialist ethics, holds that for an action to be right, it has to increase happiness in the world, and therefore that punishment is only justified when it produces a more positive balance of happiness over unhappiness than any alternative measure. An early formulation is provided, of course, by Jeremy Bentham. Quote, "The first, most extensive, and most desirable objective is to prevent, as far as it is possible and worthwhile, all sorts of offences whatsoever, and to do so at as cheap a rate as possible." For Bentham, quote, "All punishment is mischief, all punishment in itself is bad. On the principle of utility, it ought to be allowed only insofar as it promises to exclude some greater evil. Therefore, punishment ought not to be inflicted where it is groundless, where it must be ineffective, where it is unprofitable or too expensive, where it is needless." Unquote. In legal theory and criminology, the utilitarian justification of punishment has been measured through the reduction of crime. The three main ways in which it can be achieved are incapacitation, deterrence, and rehabilitation. First, incapacitation is an obvious consequence of the removal from society, whether it is through imprisonment, deportation, or execution. In the first case, which has logically received most attention, imprisonment, the effect is, of course, limited to the time spent in prison. In order to increase it, one has to resort to harsher penal legislation. This has been the strategy developed notably in the United States over the past decades, with the institution of mandatory sentencing, even for misdemeanor, and more generally with the lengthening of the sentences delivered, including lifetime for nonviolent crime in some cases. But it comes down to a tautology in terms of reasoning and an impasse in terms of policy when definitive or quasi-definitive exclusion tends to be the only viable solution. Second, deterrence is the object of much discussion due to the difficulty to measure the specific effect of the threat of sanction on crime reduction, as has been observed in North America. And here, there's a lot of controversy, but my point would be that first, contrary to the expectation of the broken window theory, more numerous officers in the streets doing more aggressive policing seems to have had marginal and inconsistent effects on crime decline in the United States, while similar benefits were obtained with opposite policies in Canada. And second, contrary to the expectations of the promoters of tough on crime programs, the massive increase in incarceration rates appears to have had a minimal impact on crime control, with diminishing returns over the years, and even no impact at all on violent crime in the United States, again with a comparably favorable evolution in Canada during the same period, when conversely, the imprisoned population decreased. And finally, rehabilitation is perhaps the dimension of punishment that has been the least studied, as its practice has been considerably discredited in the 1970s, and subsequently neglected by policymakers, especially again in the United States. In the end, the most effective dimension of punishment seems to be also the most self-evident, as well as the most problematic. Incapacitation, but only in as much as one would be ready to accept extreme policies, removing offenders from society for a very long time span at whatever cost in terms of justice, social contract, and public spending. The retributivist theory, as part of the deontological ethics, seems much easier to defend since it does not rely on any external assessment of its social effectiveness, but rather on the internal evaluation of its moral coherence. Indeed, it asserts that for justice to be done, those who have committed wrongdoings deserve to suffer. Punishment should be justified on this sole ground. The classic argument is developed by Immanuel Kant, quote, "Juridical punishment can never be administered merely as means for promoting another good, either with regard to the criminal himself or to civil society, but must in all cases be imposed only on the individual on whom it is inflicted when this individual has committed a crime." Unquote. This principle derives from the categorical imperative that humans should never be treated as means, but as ends, and therefore that one cannot punish for the greater good of society, but only because the person has been found guilty. As for the way to implement concretely this principle, equality must guide the mode and measure of punishment. Consequently, the right of retaliation implies, quote, that whoever has committed murder must die. This radical expression of retributivism has been developed in various directions, punishment being justified either to compensate the benefits unduly obtained from the wrongdoing or to correct the harms done to the victim of this wrongdoing. In these cases, it is the consequences of the act that have to be repaid. Calling for a purer version grounded on the sanction of the act for itself, Jean Hampton affirms that the only acceptable raison d'etre of retributivism is righting a wrong, as she says, the latter being defined as the infringement of a moral standard, what she described as an affront to the victim's value or dignity. Such an approach, especially when illustrated as she does with horrific examples of sadistic racism under the Jim Crow laws, ennobles the retributivist cause. Yet, it seems to apply only to a limited part of the cases actually taken to court and punished by prison sentences in countries like France or the United States, drug law violations or motor vehicle offenses, which have spectacularly increased in recent decades, cannot easily be described as affront to any victim's value or dignity. Although they are conceptually opposed and even apparently incompatible, utilitarianism and retributivism are often combined in practice. Thus, people who are in favor of harsher punishment for criminals often justify their position both in terms of incapacitation and deterrence, and in terms of just deserts and even vengeance. More generally, these various approaches, whether utilitarian, retributivist, or pluralist, have two important features in common. First, they do not only analyze justifications of punishment, they also justify punishment. Second, they do not reflect how punishment is or can be explained in the real world, they analyze how it should be justified in an ideal realm. These two features, justification rather than mere analysis of justification and defense of an ideal order rather than representation of the world as it is, may seem self-evident, since philosophy as well as law are, for the most part, normative disciplines. It is therefore expected that they would describe how things ought to be rather than how they are. However, the difference between the two is not always clearly stated or understood, and theoretical justification tends to be taken for granted as actual explanations. One of the most lucid observations in this respect is, again, reference to yesterday, Nietzsche's unequivocal statement, quote, "Today it is impossible to say for certain why people are really punished," end quote. Not that the ultimate cause would be hidden, but on the contrary, because too many reasons may be found in diverse situations or even in a given one, and Nietzsche cites more than a dozen of plausible reasons that have little to do with utilitarianism or retributivism. His long list is not so much contradictory with the classical dualism that I've described, as it is situated in a different theoretical stratum, not in the pure realm of thought and rule, but in the impure region of crime and punishment, the world of Dostoevsky rather than that of Bentham or Kant, so to speak. This is the same sort of ordeal to which theoretical reasoning is submitted when it is confronted with empirical research. I will take three brief ethnographic examples illustrating punishment in the street, in court, and in prison. First scene. Three adolescents are talking and laughing loudly in a small square near the hostel of the Youth Protection Service where they stay. The three teenagers are of African origin. Two police officers on patrols stop by and ask for their papers. Such a check is banal but illegal, since there's no indication of a crime being or having been committed, and since it is established that such stop is often based on mere racial profiling. The adolescents present their travel pass, which is normally deemed sufficient since it has their name and a photograph. Not satisfied, the agents demand their identification card. The adolescent explained that they live in the hostel some 20 yards away and proposed the officers to accompany them to get their documents. The police ruthlessly refuse and say they will take them to the precinct for further verification. Panicked at the idea of being arrested, one of the teenagers escapes, runs to his lodging, takes the requested card, and swiftly returns to prove his good faith. Yet, the reception is not what he expects. The officers scold him harshly, using racist slurs while slapping him. Alerted by the shouting, one of the social workers of the service gets out only to hear one officer threaten the boy, "I'm going to kneecap you," and yell at him, "You're a failure in your family, you're a failure at school, you little faggot." Not without difficulty, the social worker interposes herself and finally brings this adolescent back to the hostel. Second scene. A thin man in his mid-30s faces charges for driving without a license and insurance. 4 months earlier, he had a minor car accident, crashed into a signpost, and drove off. As his registration plate had fallen down, it was easy for the police to identify the vehicle, which officially belonged to his wife. He was summoned, did not go to the precinct, and after some time, two officers came to his apartment to arrest him. At the trial, the judge notes that with irritation that it's not the first time he has dealing with the justice system. Indeed, he has received 19 citations in the past 15 years, mostly for similar offenses. Born in a traveler's family, he dropped out of school, had a series of temporary jobs, and finally stabilized his professional situation for some time as a delivery driver. Under the usual pressure of this sort of activity and with the multiplication of radars on the roads in that period, he was caught several times for excessive speed, received points, and lost his license. He nevertheless continued working and was arrested several times while driving. After his last stay in prison, he remained unemployed for several months, but was eventually hired in a warehouse. When he was arrested after the car accident, he was on the verge of signing a permanent contract with his company. The trial only lasts 35 minutes and concludes with a verdict of 6 months in prison and payment of damages. In my conversation with her afterwards, the judge, disheartened, comments, quote, "We don't know what to do with these cases. We're helpless. We know he'll do it again, but we still have to apply the punishment. With his previous convictions, what else could we do? When I meet the man in prison 3 days later, he's bitter. Sure, driving without a license is illegal, but you can't call that a serious crime. It's not right that you end up together with burglars and rapists just for that. He's persuaded that the sanction has been severe because he's a Roma. Third scene, an inmate is brought into the cramped room adjacent to the solitary confinement unit where disciplinary board hearings take place. The man is accused of racist insult against a black guard as he was leaving the yard several weeks before. Normally in such case, the complaint of the officer is detailed and the report of an investigation conducted by a superior is appended. This time, the only evidence is the statement of the correctional officer, whose name is not even revealed to the prisoner. There is no witness, no specifics, no inquiry. Knowing neither who his accuser is, nor what the circumstances are, the inmate, an unpolished man, seems disconcerted. A trainee correction lieutenant who attends the hearing later comments to me that in the facility where he has been working as a guard for 10 years, they would never have taken a decision on such a vague accusation. When, after the deliberation of the jury, the prisoner is brought back into the room, he is told that he is sentenced to 7 days of solitary confinement. In an irrepressible act of rage, he punches and breaks the wooden podium behind which he stands. While he loudly protests against the unfairness of the decision, they take him to his punitive cell. The civil society volunteer who sits on the board tells me in an aside that if the man were to appeal, he would definitely win the case. A deputy warden, with whom I speak later, makes clear that even when they do not believe in the veracity of the guard's version, especially when the accusers are known for their aggressive behavior, they cannot afford to appear to disown them, she says. He who says that we decide on the sole basis of facts and inmates' profile does not tell the truth. Commenting on sentences to solitary confinement delivered for minor faults in a context of recent tensions within the prison, she adds that punishing prisoners, even when it is obvious that they have been harried and responded to provocation by an officer, serves to satisfy and appease the personnel. Quote, "It avoids the guards taking revenge on the prisoners." These three cases illustrate the diversity and intricacy of the reasons why police officers, criminal judges, and prison wardens punish. Of course, each of them is specific and not representative of punishment in law enforcement, judicial, and correctional institutions, respectively. But through them, I want to show the difficulty of answering the question, why do people punish when one is confronted with such actual situations? In the first scene, the two law enforcement agents express their diffuse resentment against the working class youth belonging to ethnic and racial minorities. The bastards, as they habitually call them, with the connotation of illegitimacy of birth associated to the word. But the combination of hostility and racism that is common among the police working in such an environment takes a moral resonance in this case. Being under the supervision of the judicial institution, the adolescents have already had dealings with the justice system either as delinquent or as victims, or more often than not, as both. Although the agents pretend to ignore that the boys live in the hostels, they evidently know where they come from and imagine what may have been their story, which justifies the way they will treat them. Hence, the refusal to consider their travel pass and threat to take them to the precinct. Hence, the humiliating and hurtful insults about the teenager's supposed failure in his family and at school. Hence, the slaps across the face and the menace to cripple him. For the officer, it is legitimate to punish the adolescents because of what he thinks they are. In the end, the psychological harassment and physical violence is an abuse of authority through which the agents do not only manifest their discretionary power, but also perform a social order in which the youth are learning their position as racial and moral inferiors. In the second scene, the judge warily indicates that she was embarrassed by the case, but felt that she had to issue a prison sentence for lack of alternative. In fact, she was not constrained by the law in her decision, as she suggests, since mandatory sentencing did not apply to the present situation. So from a utilitarian perspective, it is difficult to argue that the offender will be incapacitated since his removal from society is only for a few months, or that he will be deterred since having him lose his job can only make his re-entry more at risk of recidivism, or even that he will be rehabilitated since prison sentences of less than 6 months are excluded from programs of social reinsertion. From a retributivist viewpoint, the magistrate does not seem persuaded that he should be incarcerated, and the disenchanted tone of the private conversation contrasts with the public reprimands about his recklessness. More than anything else, incarceration seems to be the result of a judicial routine. As one of her colleagues later told me, when the legislature imposed minimal sentence time for repeat offenders in 2007, under a right-wing government, judges initially protested in the name of the individualization of sentences and the liberty of their profession. But they progressively got used to the new norm. Facts proved her right. When 5 years later, a newly appointed progressive minister of justice published a memorandum asking magistrates to interpret the law with discernment, mentioning traffic violation as example, they did not abandon the inflexible practices they seemed to have adopted reluctantly shortly before. In fact, the prison population continued to increase steadily in the following years. In the third scene, the game seems to be over even before it starts. The warden knows that despite the absence of evidence in the case on which the disciplinary board will have to decide, the fact that it is an accusation of verbal abuse against a guard renders a sanction necessary. He anticipates that officers and inmates will scrutinize the judgment. An adjournment of the case for lack of established proof and investigation report, or worse, a clement verdict, would be regarded on both sides as an implicit condemnation of the personnel. The prisoners would regard it as a victory, and the news would soon be disseminated through the entire facility. The guards would interpret it as an absence of support from their institution, and their unions would probably express their anger. The sanction of solitary confinement is a tactic of peacekeeping in which showing fairness is secondary to maintaining order. No one is fooled, the wardens are realistic about it, the prisoners view it as one more injustice of the system, even the guards seem to be aware of it, as they tell me in private that it was no surprise to them that this colleague would have been insulted or assaulted, considering the bully he was, but this would not prevent them from protesting had the provoked inmate not be punished. One could, of course, interpret the reasoning of the warden as utilitarian, but the anticipated consequences here are not the reduction of offenses among prisoners, but the prevention of potential disorder at the cost of justice. So in the reconstitution of the possible answers to the question, why do people punish, I have in each of the three cases moved from the justifications provided by the agents to the explanations resulting from a distance analysis, or better said, the work of interpretation has consisted in integrating the local justifications into broader explanations. This analytic distinction between justification and explanation is important, although not often made explicit. The police's claim that they enforce the law can be read as their eagerness to impose a social and racial order in the name of morality. The judge's affirmation that she merely applies the legislation can be construed as the manifestation of an expanding culture of severity in criminal courts. The disciplinary board's trial offering a semblance of justice within the prison can be viewed as a politics of pacification at the cost of unfair practices. In other words, the sense of entitlement of the officers who abused the adolescent of African origin, the routine of the sanctioning of the magistrate who sent the Roma driver without license to prison, and the pretense of lawfulness of the warden who sentences the unruly inmate to solitary confinement, produce punishments inscribed within a range of possible actions which characterizes a given historical, political, and social context. Until now, both justification and explanation of punishment have been presented in a rational frame through the alternative between utilitarianism and retributivism, or the various logics of social order, bureaucratic routine, and institutional peacekeeping. But the interpretation must go further. Punishment constitutes an emotional reaction, affirms Durkheim. Trying to understand why it is always in excess, why shame doubles suffering, why disgrace supplements exclusion, why cruelty surfaces in the infliction of pain, he suggests that these unnecessary sanctions, quote, are a form of additional tribulation that serves no purpose or one whose sole reason is the need to repay evil with evil. Before him, Nietzsche has even been more explicit, speaking of, quote, a recompense in the form of a kind of pleasure. For him, punishing was not simply repaying evil with evil, but producing a gratuitous evil for the mere satisfaction of doing so. In the act of punishing, something resists rational analysis, or better said, resists being analyzed as rational. A repressed drive to make suffer, which society tends to delegate to certain institutions and professions. Prisons and correctional officers occupy an extreme position in this process because they deal with a captive, already condemned population, and they do so out of the sight of society. In the United States, numerous complaints of abuse perpetrated against prisoners have been reported, and statistical studies conducted in correctional facilities have established the banality of physical, psychological, and sexual violence. Even when death occurs and evidence of mistreatment is provided, no administrative sanction is taken, nor is any criminal charge filed. Cruelty seems a normalized way of dealing with the prison population, as if inmates were indefinitely punishable and as if guards were permitted unrestricted discretion. Difficult to imagine in European democracies, the situation encountered in the United States prison represents a limit case that, however, illuminates the emotional dimension and potential excess which, under ordinary circumstances, are simultaneously present and repressed in punishment.
This is Big Ideas on RN and online. As Didier Fasson explains, the act of a crime depends on social conventions, and who should be punished is indicative of moral hierarchies. We don't condemn something because it is a crime, but it is a crime because we condemn it. At Berkeley University, Didier Fasson continues with the second Tanner lecture on the will to punish.
The pleasure of punishing suggests that the question why punish is probably inseparable from another how does one punish? Indeed, the examination of the way in which pain is inflicted opens new avenues for the understanding of punishment that are rarely explored. We are far from both the Benthamian idea of punishment being justified on the condition that it benefits to society and the Kantian principle of equal measure between the crime and its sanction, and we are reminded that rational justifications do not suffice to explain punishment. But punishment, especially in its harshest form, is not evenly allocated across society. So the question, who is punished? The distribution of punishment depends on the determination of what is considered an offense and how it is sanctioned. In other words, to ask who is punished is to ask simultaneously what is punished. Indeed, crime is differentiated across society in terms of the sort of violation committed as well as the characteristics of the commission. Although both are financial crimes, bank robbery and tax evasion definitely correspond to different social worlds. The use of the same illegal drugs follows distinct practice in the middle class or upper class and in housing projects, which are not exposed to the same sanctions. Consequently, the way in which the law is written and enforced determines which crime and public are punished. These variations have led Durkheim to reverse the common sense relationship between crime and punishment. For him, a crime is, quote, any act which, regardless of degree, provokes again the perpetrator the characteristic reaction known as punishment, unquote. And developing his argument, he famously continues, we must not say that an act offends the common consciousness because it is criminal, but it is criminal because it offends the common consciousness. We do not condemn it because it is a crime, but it is a crime because we condemn it. Thus, the acts we call crime depend on social convention, and the choices regarding who should be punished are indicative of moral hierarchies. Remarkably, however, these hierarchies do not reflect the seriousness of the consequences of the acts committed. Whereas murder is generally deemed the greatest crime in modern society, comments Durkheim, an economic crisis or a company bankruptcy may have much worse consequences for many, but those responsible for it are rarely held accountable. One could certainly prolong his reasoning and argue that the moral hierarchy reveals a social hierarchy, which explains why bankers and managers are more easily exonerated than ordinary citizens. What is punished and who is punished remains open questions. To answer them, a case in point, which has also been the most studied, is that of the United States. It is both exceptional for the extreme severity of its punitive system and the profound disparities in distribution, and exemplary in that it reveals general mechanism of differentiation in the allocation of punishment. With more than 700 per 100,000 of the national population, the country has the highest incarceration rate in the world, far above Russia and China, thus apparently refuting Montesquieu's statement, severity in penalties suit despotic government, whose principle is terror, better than monarchies and republics, which have honor and virtue for their spring. In these states, a good legislator will insist less on punishing crimes than on preventing them. It would be easy to prove that in all or nearly all states of Europe, penalties have decreased in proportion as one has approached or departed from liberty, unquote. Had he lived in the present time, the author of The Spirit of the Laws might have revised this analysis to take into account not only the severity in the penalties, but also its distribution across society, so as to describe the paradoxical case of democracies for which liberty and equality are in such tension that the deprivation of the former becomes the most effective marker of the failure of the latter. Indeed, in no other domain than that of punishment are the two cardinal values of democracy working so much together to combine their negative effects. The more severe, the more unfair. There is probably no democratic country in which this correlation has not been evidenced. As shown by Bruce Western, black men in the United States have incarceration rates 8 times higher than white men, this ratio being much higher than for other criteria like unemployment or wealth. Among high school dropouts between 20 and 40 years old, 1 black man out of 3 is in correctional facility on any given day, and blacks are 5 times more often in prison than whites, while the latter benefit almost twice as much from the welfare system than the former. That punishment would not be equally allocated among the members of a given society is anything but unexpected. The fact is commonly observed in very different contexts. Among the Zande of Northern Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance, punishment depended on both who was offended and who was the offender. Offenses against the chief were more severely sanctioned than similar offenses among the rest of the group, and retribution was harsher on low-ranked individuals than on members of the ruling clan. While, quote, a commoner was liable to punishment for every offense against another commoner or an office holder, it was unlikely for him to dare to establish guilt on the part of even the most powerless of the ruling clan. Similarly, among Moroccans under the Saadi dynasty, the status of the person who had committed the crime decisively influenced the sentence. The difference in treatment was legitimized by hadith, which implied that high-rank individuals should be forgiven because, quote, for them, reprobation is more painful than physical chastisement, end quote. Nowhere is this moral literally more true than in the United States. However, it is in another country where socioeconomic and ethno-racial inequality in punishment has long been ignored that I want to explore this phenomenon further, France. In the past 60 years, the number of inmates increased from 20,000 to 68,000. I know the figures are very small for a US audience. Corresponding to a multiplication of the incarceration rate this time, by 2.5, despite, and this is important, despite a significant decline in crime rate before and during that period, particularly for the most serious ones, homicide and robberies. This dramatic evolution took place in a context of growing anxiety fueled by the far right, the right, and ultimately the left, regarding immigration and insecurity, culminating with the expansion of the correctional population by 52% between 2002 and 2012 under successive conservative governments. These long-term trends did not affect all categories in the same way. The working class and the jobless represent 3/4 of the carceral population, and the risk of being imprisoned is 16 times higher for men who dropped out of school before the age of 16 than for those who studied beyond 20 years old. In the facility where I conducted my research, half the men were unemployed, half of them declared no profession, 4 out of 5 had not finished high school or had a vocational degree, while only 1% belonged to management. Although little known and debated, these socioeconomic data about the distribution of punishment do exist. Such is not the case for ethno-racial disparities, for which the production of statistics is forbidden in France, a legal obstacle that contributes to the denial of the problem. Despite this prohibition, at the end of my 4-year ethnographic study in a short-stay prison, I conducted a survey among its 900 inmates and found out that ethnic and racial minorities represented 77% of the prisoners, including 35% blacks, 32% Arab men, and 5% Roma people. In order to check whether these figures did not result from a specific recruitment, I compared the local and national prison populations using two proxies, namely the proportion of working class and unemployed and the proportion of non-nationals differentiated by their origin. The demographics are almost similar. It seemed, therefore, likely that the facility I had studied was not an outlier. The combination of socioeconomic and ethno-racial definition within the prison population suggests that the French correctional institution resembles that of the United States more than one could have imagined, with the major difference, of course, that the total incarceration rate is 7 times lower in France than in the United States. In fact, the general mechanism that can explain such disparities in the distribution of sentences are not so different in both countries. They involve the entire production of the penal chain, from the construction of public problems and their translation into legislation, to the work of the police and the decision of the judges. At each stage, it is easy to see how the same populations are targeted despite the apparent universalism of the law and the neutrality of its enforcement. The case of drug law violations is particularly telling. In France, since the passing of the 1970 legislation criminalizing drug abuse, the number of arrests has increased by a factor of 60. But whereas the law had been initially conceived to fight the heroin epidemic, which was then causing numerous deaths, it now concerns mostly marijuana which has been legalized in various parts of the world, and including not very far from here. And while it originally targeted traffickers, it ends up focusing on consumers. While drug dealers only represent 0.25% of inmates, cannabis use accounts for 3.5% of all incarceration, and possession or resale of small quantity of this substance for 14%. Moreover, youth arrests and conviction for drug law violations affect almost exclusively disadvantaged minorities from housing projects. Yet, epidemiological studies indicate that the proportion of marijuana users is not higher among them than in the rest of the population. The disparities in the prison population are due to differences not in illegal practices, but in the way they are punished, that is, in the work of both the police and the judges. Significantly, during the 2000s, convictions for the use of marijuana increased by 255% in 10 years, while convictions for infringement on legislation on business decreased by 29%. The political priority regarding what should be punished was determined by the choice of who was to be punished. As Foucault famously observed, quote, "The prison, and no doubt punishment in general, is not intended to eliminate offenses, but rather to distinguish them, to distribute them, to use them," unquote. The prisoners are not taken in by this function of punishment. The poor and the rich do not commit the same violation of the law. The former are involved in drugs or theft, while the latter embezzle funds or evade taxes. But society punishes petty crime much more harshly than financial crime. The interpretation of these disparities should, however, not be limited to the penal chain. It must include the analysis of the social structure. Targeted legislation, discriminatory policing, and biased judicial practices do not suffice to explain the spectacular discrepancies in prison population across social class and color lines. Such discrepancies involve the entire society and reflect its unequal structure, as been argued by Loïc Vacon. In France, the rapid expansion in prison population from the 1980s on is concomitant with a steep increase in economic inequality, which occurs, as demonstrated by Thomas Piketty, after 3 decades of economic growth, quasi full employment, and improvement of living conditions known as the Trente Glorieuses. The parallel evolution of the two phenomena is particularly dramatic from 2002 to 2012, a decade during which conservative governments simultaneously debilitated the welfare state and strengthened the penal state. The correctional population augmented by more than one half, as I mentioned before, as a consequence of an increase of the number of incarceration and of the duration of the prison sentences. While the ratio between the superior and inferior deciles of the income distribution grew from 6.2 to 7.2, as a result, in particular, of a rise in earnings 115 times faster at the top than at the bottom. Although one cannot mechanistically link the trends in the evolution of social inequality and of the prison population, it remains that in times of deepening of economic discrepancies, the penal instrument does not only serve to control crime and criminals, it also disciplines and polices the disadvantaged. But the political economy of punishment does not say it all. Punishment is also a question of values and affects. One has therefore to examine also its moral economy. From the 18th century on, the modernity of punishment had been the addition of a reformative project to the retributive function. To punish was to inflict pain, but it was also supposed to lead the criminal to amend, educate and redeem, as much as discipline and punish. However, the description of prison in the United States as well as in France in the 19th century suggests that, in fact, the balance between retribution and reformation was never achieved elsewhere than in the mind of the inventors and promoters of the modern prison. The illusion was nevertheless somehow maintained until the 1970s, when the reformative project got discredited and the retributive function definitely gained ground, ending the period of penal welfareism, as David Garland names it. Of the contemporary moral economy, I will retain three elements that I think are crucial for the understanding of the unequal distribution of retribution across society: the recognition of the victim, the individualization of responsibility, and the emphasis on suffering in punishment. Firstly, the emergence of the figure of the victim is a recent phenomenon. Yet, because it has become so prominent and legitimate through the representations of battered children, bullied adolescents, abused women, people affected by disasters or conflicts, one tends to forget that until a few decades ago, these categories did not even exist. The acknowledgement of victims has contributed to vilifying the perpetrator, and in the end, justifying not only the severity of punishment, but also its function of retribution rather than deterrence or rehabilitation. But this moral order is also a social order. Not all victims are equally treated. When a man is beaten or even killed by a police officer in the street or by a correctional officer in prison, the institution endeavors to depict him as a criminal and to prevent him from being regarded as a victim, which explains in large part why it is difficult to have fair investigation in such cases. This representational struggle is indeed essential in the process of qualification or disqualification as victims of individuals who are subjected to violence. Secondly, that the responsibility for one's act be the justification for one's punishment seems to be so self-evident that it is almost never questioned. Yet, in many societies, studied by ethnologists in particular, individual responsibility was not at stake in the way a wrong was repaired. By contrast, the logic of the modern justice system relies entirely on the demonstration of this responsibility. In the case of crime, not only does it construct guilt and legitimize punishment, but it also exonerates society from its accountability. The univocal relationship between the wrongdoing and the wrongdoer desocializes crime. The idea that social conditions may have played a role disappears. The paradox is, however, that while considering the individual solely accountable, the criminal justice system actually penalizes not only the culprit, but also his entourage. His spouse and children in particular are subjected to a vicarious punishment that contributes to the precarity and instability of the family. While denying the social production of crime, the state thus participates in its social reproduction. Finally, the nagging question of the infliction of pain to the offender and the satisfaction it procures remains. Once more, this necessity and the affect attached to it do not appear to have always existed everywhere, as ethnologic studies have shown. Paradoxically, in the apparently neutral contemporary judiciary system, the resentment of the legislator, the police and the magistrates, but also of the public and the media, often surfaces. One particular manifestation of it is the current success of public shaming in the United States, both in its traditional form of exposing culprits carrying signs proclaiming their crime, or through social media. Similarly, the multiplication of television programs and channels dedicated to the social world of repression, whether the police, justice, or prison, reveals the attraction exercised on the public by the exhibition of arrests of sex offenders, scenes of violence in maximum security facilities, and various forms of humiliation in reality shows. Contrary to what Foucault had imagined, far from having faded away, both cruel practices and their pornographic display remain lively in the contemporary spectacle of punishment. Certainly less extreme than the public torments of the past, but no less a source of ambiguous emotions. In this context, the recent call in the United States for a return to corporal punishment is hardly a surprise, and a recent proposal by a criminologist to let offenders choose between prison and flogging sentences is more than a mere provocation or return of the repressed, since, of course, it was the typical retribution of black slaves. It is an ironic reminder that punishment has not lost its dual historical feature, avatar of the physical marking of bodies, and memory of its unequal distribution across social classes and racial groups. Conclusion. To an observer, Belonging to a different society, certain of our practices would appear to be similar in nature to anthropophagy, which we deemed so alien to our notion of civilization. I'm thinking of our customs regarding justice and prison. Thus, writes Claude Lévi-Strauss, as you probably guessed, in a famous passage of Triste Tropique. If such an observer, he continues, were to consider the solution consisting in dealing with dangerous individuals by, quote, expelling them out of the social body and keeping them temporarily or definitively isolated from the rest of humanity in establishment especially intended for this purpose, most of those we call primitive would regard such a custom with profound horror, unquote. This text was published in 1955 at a time when the French prison population was at its lowest level. Certainly, Lévi-Strauss' critique of the humaneness of our justice system might have been even more severe had he been writing six decades later, when the number of inmates is multiplied by three in France and is more than 100 times higher in the United States. And to shake our moral assurance, he would perhaps, Claude Lévi-Strauss would perhaps, have imagined his fictitious observer wondering which is the cruelest treatment one can apply against one's enemies. Their videotape beheading, usually deemed the ultimate form of barbarity, or their secret indefinite detention, their torture by beatings, waterboarding, sexual abuse, sleep deprivation, forced feeding, exposure to loud music and extreme temperatures. He might even have justified his parallel by the fact that the former practice is showcased as a parody of the latter, since the victims wear the same orange jumpsuit. Yet Lévi-Strauss was not a provocateur, nor was he a postmodern relativist. He was an heir of the Enlightenment and affirmed that he would have preferred to live in the 19th century. This is why he thought anthropology could teach his contemporaries lessons by questioning their prejudices against others and their self-evident truth about themselves. Challenging our certainties regarding punishment, or as Clifford Geertz has it, keeping the world off balance, pulling out rugs, upsetting tea tables, setting off firecrackers, is what I have tried to do in these lectures, resorting to an anthropological approach, using our capacity to be surprised. Such an endeavor is certainly timely. Western nations have arrived, I believe, to a profound crisis of their model of punishment. In Europe, after several decades of constant increase, the prison population has recently started to decline, France being an exception to this evolution. In the United States, the mass incarceration project has suddenly appeared untenable in a rare bipartisan fit of awareness that still remains to be concretized. But the reversal of the trend I have analyzed is late, modest in its intensity, and partial in its extension. The time may therefore have come for our contemporaries to finally realize that at least in most Western democracies, they are going through the least violent period of their history and yet the most punitive. Thank you.
French sociologist and anthropologist Didier Fasson looking at what is punishment, why punish, and who is punished. Thanks to UC Berkeley for providing this year's Tanner Lectures on Human Values. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
From the founder of Apple to comedian Andy Samberg, from the head of Netflix to the man who built the World Wide Web, from the creators of the record-breaking podcast Serial to startups that are breaking ground right here in Australia, if you want to hear from the movers and the shakers, media, technology and culture around Australia and the globe, there is literally one show. It also happens to be the most literally named show. Download this show with me, Mark Fennell, media, technology, culture. Find it on the RN website now or on the ABC Radio app.